everybody.
Hello.
It is another episode of Cafeteria Christian. How lucky for you.
We are
here.
We are a podcast of people who are fans of Jesus, yes. Or at least have heard about him and are generally pro. And then we meet some of his followers and we become very quickly con.
Yeah. Or, you know, we move from being pro to like on the fence.
Yeah. Or sort of a wild vacillation. I don't feel like on the fence is accurate. I feel like what I'm mostly doing is like leaping an electric fence multiple times a day.
That does seem about right. Today we have two of your hosts and a special guest. So I am Natalia Turfa, and our other host with us today, you've heard her voice already.
I'm Emmy Kegler.
And today we have this wonderful guest with us. Angela, you want to say hi?
Hi, everybody. Glad to be here.
This is Angela Denker. Angela is an author, and she happens to also be a pastor. And we are so excited to have her with us today.
Yes, this is the three professional Christian weirdos.
Yeah. Oh, that's fun. We've never had three professional Christian weirdos on at the same time. Mm-hmm.
All at the same time.
Excellent. Angela, just so you know, that is what Nora calls lady pastors, or maybe just pastors. It's professional okay. Christian weirdos.
Okay.
So there you have it. Which, you know, I think is accurate. So sometimes, most of the time.
That's good.
Yeah, it's good. All right. So, Emmy.
Yes. No, don't do the thing.
Okay. So, Nora's not here, which means we can skip what's
fine.
On your tray.
It's fine. People like it. Let's respect it. Angela, Nora, so you may have noticed that the logo for Cafeteria Christian looks like a cafeteria tray. And so Nora has been probably for 2 years now trying to get the expression "what's on your tray" to catch on as a way of reflecting of sort of what's on our mind and in our hearts going as we're going into recording. And I don't know why. At this point, I think it's just performative. I hate it. I don't know why. Today I am, what's on my tray, Natalia, is that I am taking over the Instagram of our dear alma mater, St. Olaf College, today.
Woo!
Because it's Spirit Week, LGBT Spirit Week, and LGBT History Month, and they were like, "Hey, let's get a queer pastor on there." So I'm doing that, and that is nerve-wracking in multiple directions because I feel like Instagram is where you have ages from all across the board meeting. Like there are people who are 18 who literally like were born when I was in college. And then people who are 70, and I'm just like, I don't know this audience, and I feel a little tense about this. So this is going to be like when I'm on TikTok, I'm like, I know what audience this is. Like this is for 20-year-olds. When I'm on Facebook, I'm like, I know what audience this is. When I'm on Twitter, Twitter's a cesspool anyway. So like that audience is just a garbage pile, with like demons crawling out of it. And this is a whole new game. I've already had to censor myself multiple times where I would like record something and they'll go, "Oh, I probably can't say that." So I'm feeling a little stressed.
Ooh.
Yep. So Angela, what's on your tray?
Well, when we're talking about trying to get things to catch on, all I can think about is like, which is pathetic. But all I can think about is Mean Girls and Fetch. Yes. Like we're just trying to make it happen.
It's exactly
like that. Yeah.
So I don't know, you guys, I'm wondering what this conversation is going to be like, because it's been such a weird last 24 hours. And I think we're going to be talking about America and the election, which is had been on my tray since it's been the topic of my book for a few years now. And we can't escape it. And then all these strange things are happening. A few minutes ago when we started recording, a bird flew full speed into the window that I was sitting in front of to record.
It's just not a good sign.
Yeah, just I guess it just could not stand to be present, so it just had to off itself. But we also had a mouse. It was very sad, actually, a mouse with a broken leg in our laundry room a few hours ago. Aww. So it's been a very strange morning. And I have family coming into town, which also we can talk about later as sort of part of the personal perspective that we all are dealing with in this divided political country. So, yeah, lots on my tray and lots of coffee in my mug, which is good.
Well, on my actual tray, my beloved just brought in his, so my husband took the day off of work today. And he just brought me in two pancakes that he made because he's making pancake breakfast for him. Aww. And my daughter, and we babysat our, or we just did a sleepover with my nephews last night. So we're all chugging coffee this morning, but he made pancakes. And the other thing that's on my tray slash out my window is it just started snowing.
Yeah.
No. And I'm like,
right now,
I'm like, yeah, y'all, I'm not sure I'm quite, I love winter, but I'm not sure I'm ready for, I'm not ready yet. So trying to take some deep breaths and remind myself that it's not the kind that will last. It's fine. Everything's fine. We're all fine. So Angela, we referenced this a little bit. We're going to talk about the election and the state of the country and some of these things. But we're going to talk about it from a different perspective because you have written this book. It came out a couple years ago, but I would say many of our listeners maybe have heard of it sort of on the periphery, or they haven't heard of it yet. And so I want to give you just an opportunity to talk about how that book came about and sort of your credentials, because I think that matters in this conversation. And I would also like to just talk, well, let's just start there and we'll move into the family stuff too. Mm-hmm. But let's just talk about the book and kind of how it came to be and how you came to write that.
Yeah, I'll try to give somewhat of a Cliff Notes version. So I think I did say a couple of years, but it's actually only been out a little over a year. I think.
Oh my gosh, are you serious?
I know. I think time has stretched with the pandemic. But yeah, it came out in August 2019, and I began. So I spent 2018 traveling across America to red states and counties to interview Christians who voted for Trump, and also. You know, not everyone who's in the book was a Trump voter. I also just wanted to get a broad swath of opinions and stories and perspective from Christians living in red states and counties. And so I kind of came to the book from three different perspectives, one of which is my background as a reporter and as a journalist. I have an undergrad degree in journalism, and I spent about 5 years working as a sports writer, covered hockey, covered the Super Bowl, covered the NCAA Final Four, wrote for Sports Illustrated briefly. So it kind of brought that perspective into this work of really telling people's stories. And in that sense, I was a little bit frustrated as a journalist in seeing reporting leading up to and in the aftermath of the 2016 election and the role of Christians in the election. A lot of that reporting sort of came from like a helicopter perspective, and it lacked nuance and it lacked depth, especially when telling the stories of rural voters and of Christian voters. So I really wanted in this book to give people a chance to tell their stories in their own words. And I wanted to tell stories that tended to be missing from the national media, particularly stories of Christians of color in red states and counties. Those stories are often missing and are very important. So that's the first perspective as a journalist. After working in sports writing, I moved from the hockey locker room to the seminary, which was an interesting transition, but certainly prepared me for any kind of criticism that I get as a pastor, because you can't compete with the hockey fans. So I'm very prepared
<No kidding.
laughs> for any kind of hatred I might get. But yeah, so went to seminary, worked as a pastor in Las Vegas, in Chicago, and then in Orange County, California. And I was serving a large, sort of Lutheran in name, more evangelical in style and in culture church in Orange County during the 2016 election. Hmm. And actually, my church was located across the street from the Richard Nixon Presidential Library in Yorba Linda, California. So sort of tells you the... Yeah, that's one of the trivia questions I always ask people when I'm talking about the book. so I really get to see in Orange County, there's a very broad sense of sort of pop culture, mega church, wealthy Christian culture. And that led me to see what was happening in the 2016 election with the embrace of Christians for Donald Trump, and also the theological underpinnings of what was happening for Christians who the broader country was confused about how Christians could have embraced this president. And I think there's a lot of theological underpinnings that I'm sure you two are aware of as well. And then finally, my perspective was personal and just coming from a family itself. My husband's family and most of the people that we went to college with in Missouri and his friends growing up are all, you know, big Trump supporters. And then my family tends to be more sort of middle of the road, sort of Minnesota Democrats, Minnesota nice Democrats, I suppose. So yeah, I brought those perspectives and got to write this book, which is called Red State Christians. And the subtitle, which is not my favorite, but it says, understanding the voters who elected Donald Trump. And I think at this point, it's not necessarily about understanding, but more about meeting people. I don't propose to say that this book's going to give you the full understanding, but I do think it's going to allow you to meet people and allow you to also perhaps meet God in the midst of these pages and where God is active in American politics or not.
Whew. Oh boy.
I know. Are we done now?
Right. And that's a wrap. Thanks all for joining us. Please go cry into your favorite beverage.
So, Angela, I'm curious if you, I know you've been out sort of talking about this book pretty regularly, and I'm more curious about how your perspective has changed between when you wrote it and the current landscape. I think it feels to me like there was a concerted effort to try to understand perspectives right after 2016 of people being like, oh, I'm really in a bubble. Oh, I need to widen my scope of who I talk to and my community and try to understand where people are coming from because this was such a surprise to me. And now I feel like the opposite is happening where people are like, I don't care to understand, and I would like to shut down my bubble, and I would like to stop hearing from people who think different from me. And I think that's dangerous, but I also think it's understandable. So I'm just curious what your experience is, you know, in all your conversations and meeting people, how that's changed, how you're coming into this current, I don't want to say climate. Ugh, I hate saying that. But just like the
time. Oh, we're in another election. Like, what's the, right. Yeah, how have things shifted? It's snowing here now. Ugh.
Oh, I'm sorry. I know. It's just brutal. It feels right for this conversation. I suppose
that's right. All right.
It does. It definitely. We're seeing a few flakes back here as well. I think we're all in the same city environs, but in different corners. So this.
Right. You guys said, "Oh, it's snowing," and I'm like, "Well, that's probably headed towards east." So
yeah,
here it is now.
No, as Natalia, as you were talking, I was sort of nodding the whole time, because. In a sense, everything has changed since 2016. And of course, we have a very, very different election. And just the first point that I always sort of make is that one constant throughout my research and my interviews and time spent in the book was this concerted, deep-rooted antipathy towards Hillary Clinton in particular. on the part of many Christian voters and many people in general living in red states and counties. So that's a distinct change for 2016 that Joe Biden, by virtue partially of being a man, does not enjoy that same deep-seated, and also because of just years of right-wing media, Christian media attention paid to Hillary Clinton. That really changes this election just in a very broad sense. But what I'll also say too, getting at the deeper part of this question, is that I think my biggest value when it came to writing this book was truth. And so beyond just this sort of surface sense of, well, we're going to listen to each other and we're going to understand, I also have a deep sense as a journalist and as a Christian that all people have a right to their own voice and to tell their own story. But not all truths are equal. that there is a responsibility that I felt in this book, and I think that I did so, which was to present and to say, we can find empathy in one another. There are valid concerns that some Christian Trump voters had that have not been adequately addressed by either party. But also underneath some of that value, there's something deeply wrong in American Christianity that was exposed by Donald Trump, and that has continued to be raised up. And I think particularly for me, since the book came out, has been this ongoing revelation about, I write a lot about Christian nationalism and about this sense that a lot of American Christians have that Jesus is American, and we have to be reminded, no, Jesus is not American. But a deeper sense in 2020 that perhaps the more important truth is not only that Jesus is not American, but that Jesus is not white. Mm. And the huge sub-theme of racism throughout the book that I've been called to sort of speak more explicitly about since that came out.
Whew. What have you... So many questions. Okay.
What I know, I'm like writing stuff down. Right. I'm like, okay, Angela, be prepared for us here.
It's full on blizzard here too. So I'm ready.
Yeah, it's also doing that here. So what are you seeing? What do you think you're seeing trajectory wise as far as conversations within American Christianity sort of post 2016? And do you think that the landscape is shifting at all, or have we, as Natalia described, sort of bubbled up and like, we're not speaking to each other? By we, I mean, like, you know, people like me and people who are diametrically opposed to people like me having rights. Like, we're just not speaking to each other, and we're going to be on these two separate sides, and you're going to refuse to acknowledge that I have any sense of religion. Like, is that, are we still there, or has there been any progress? Has there been any self-reckoning within sort of American Christianity about what it means to have elected Donald Trump?
Well, I'm going to answer your question maybe in kind of a surprising way, but I think it sort of parallels my own evolution understanding of what it means to be church in America and what it means to be, maybe in Nora's words, a professional Christian weirdo right now. So I came into seminary and into my ministry work, and we can laugh, it's fine. But I had this idea that I was going to be one of the first female megachurch pastors. I mean, I wanted to have this voice in an evangelical arena at large churches. And I grew up at a very large church. I was confirmed with 200 kids. And I really believed in this idea that large churches could be great vehicles for the gospel. And as I began working in large churches and evangelical settings, well, I met some incredible people and had really great experiences and learned a lot. I also really was confronted with the underbelly of what happens when Christianity and wealth and power come together in America. And it's to see really clearly how the gospel is corrupted and how difficult it is when you have you know, a $40,000 a month mortgage on a church building to really say, but our mission's going to be paramount about Jesus. Mm-hmm. It's just a very difficult thing to do. And so I was sort of, I think, disciplined in a sense to be forced to say some of these ideas that I had about church were wrong, and that that sometimes it's not a cop out to say that sometimes the Christian community in America is going to have to get smaller as it recommits itself to the gospel. So I think in a broader sense, what we're seeing happening in the electorate and in voting patterns, a big trend that I've been pretty committed to, and I think is still probably going to hold true, is that I think that Trump's evangelical base, people who are going to call themselves evangelicals in polling as voting, I wouldn't be surprised to see his percentage among that type of voter be higher, and that support be more entrenched. But I think what you're also seeing happening alongside that is there's a lot of people who have left evangelicalism, who maybe have left, you know, official Christianity. I don't necessarily think that they've left Jesus, but, you know, so I do think that Trump's overall share of the electorate, a lot of the folks that I talked to who may have been anyone but Hillary voters, I do think a lot of those people's opinions have been sort of swayed and shifted over the years. And I think one of the biggest factors in changing that evangelical electorate has been in evangelical women. And I think the movement of Me Too and even Church Too and the exposure of church of abuse in the American church has been a huge factor in changing and breaking down some of that evangelical alliance to conservative right-wing causes.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. Angela, you mentioned some familial challenges in that your family or your family by marriage or extended family, it does not necessarily have the same views as you do. I think that is a huge percentage of our community of cafeteria Christians. I sort of feel like, you know, your book is Red State Christians, and I feel like our community could be like Red Family Christians. Where like they really do feel like a blue dot in a red sea. And right. I think a lot of our community is full of people who are like, I feel so alone out here in this, and really have, you know, come to this community because they're needing something more than that. So I'm just curious, because you said you talked to lots of Christians in red states. I'm wondering how many of those people you talked to in red states were not conservative necessarily, but they're the blue dot in a red sea, and sort of what your learnings have been about that, and sort of any helpful word of hope or advice for people who are that blue dot in a red sea.
Oh, and while we're on it, like the Electoral College is just trash, right? Like we're all agreed. Like there should not, I mean, like there are blue dots and red seas, and we should, like the fact that there are blue dots and red seas, we should not have a voting system that disregards like 50% of the votes in America because they are in states that are not the same as their own vote, right? Like that's just,
well, okay, great. Disenfranchisement of, you know, 3 million voters.
Right.
That, yeah.
Great. Okay. Now you can take the question, but I just had to, just have been chewing on that for a hot, like a couple days of just like, this needs to be burned to the ground. Everyone in America should have a vote, and under the Electoral College, you don't.
Well, and not even just the Electoral College, but right. The campaigns of voter suppression, particularly, you know, right. Places like North Carolina and, yeah, so we can talk more about that.
Yes, my apologies. So, go on.
No, it's important. So Natalia's question about a family. I think that those type of experiences were so much also of my motivation to write this book as well. Because after the 2016 election, working as a pastor in Orange County. And just interestingly, before 2016, Orange County had not voted for a Democratic candidate for president since 1932.
Wow.
And in 2016, Orange County actually flipped to vote for Hillary Clinton. However, like much of the rest of America, Orange County itself was quite polarized. And the white voters in Orange County were still overwhelmingly conservative, many of whom, shockingly, of course, were part of my Lutheran church. So anyway, what I experienced in the aftermath of the 2016 election, and I experienced it with the pastor I was working with at the time, was exactly this sense of fissure in families. And I think we can all remember that first 2016 Thanksgiving and people mm-hmm. saying, you know, what are we going to say on Thanksgiving? What's it going to be like? And, you know, my pastoral colleague and I watched, this being Southern California, we had fellowship time outdoors after church in between services. And we would watch, you know, people who had been friends for decades, for a long time, all of a sudden they're not sitting together anymore. People are just angry, that short fuse. And I don't know if that's let up over the last 4 years. I think it's almost intensified, this sense of shared national anxiety and shared national suspicion of one another that, again, I want to really be careful in how I talk about this in terms of race. And I think that often when we're talking about this fissure and division in families and in Christian families, often, not exclusively, but often we're talking about white families and white Christians and white people being forced to sort of confront to see, well, how is racism operating in my family and my family's political beliefs? And so I think the hope comes out of this sense that families and the local church do remain places where conversations grounded in empathy can be possible, and conversations grounded in truth can be possible. But I think it continues to get more and more difficult. And I've even experienced that myself, you know, over this past summer, watching some of the beginning of the Major League Baseball season with some family members and their sort of dismay when there's these large demonstrations taking place in professional sports around Black Lives Matter. And myself having, you know, lived 4 miles from where George Floyd was killed and having participated in protests. And also on my other side, my brother and sister-in-law are expecting a niece or nephew. We don't know yet. But their child is going to be Black. My sister-in-law's Black. And so how do I confront that on both when, you know, parts of my family are unwilling to say Black Lives Matter and suggesting that perhaps it's Marxist. And then on the other side, thinking that, you know, my brother has to think about what it's going to be like to raise a Black child in America in this setting. Mm-hmm. So it continues to be a struggle, but I think it's also incumbent upon those of us to not give up, to not silence our voices. And also in the same sense to protect ourselves and to know when, you know, Emmy brings up the dehumanization of LGBTQ people in the midst of this administration. And so that's, you know, don't sacrifice your humanity to work to be present in these families. But if you can, you know, continue to speak truth within your family, I would say.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. That's been a huge journey for, so I run, or I'm a co-leader of our Queer Grace. Gosh, I just got so sad that I can't talk. I'm a co-leader of our Queer Grace community outreach ministry that particularly leads and centers its work around LGBTQ plus Christians. And so much of the past 3 years has been like, how do we coexist with family and, you know, trying to support people who are at so many different trajectories in their life where like, I want to go in and fight with my family. I want to like have these conversations with them. I feel fired up about it. So like I carry that passion with me to people who are like, I want to just like, I just want to survive. I love my family, or they're precious to me, or I have, you know, personal values that tell me that I want to keep getting along with my family. And so like, I just want to get through dinner without, you know, having my sexuality or my gender identity dragged into it, versus people who are like, I'm ready to cut them the F off. And what is wrong with all of you who are still having these conversations or still spending time with them, and trying to negotiate all of those passions, which go in three very different directions and are very contradictory of each other, of a community, has been, that's a lot of pastoral tending.
Well, thank you.
I'm not saying I'm doing it well. Let me be very clear. It's been stumbling the whole way. But no, I know that of like, when do we go to bat and have these conversations, yeah, especially when they are so close to our hearts? Like when this is not just an intellectual or a political conversation, but this is like, this is my life. Like the decisions that you are making in the voting booth are,
right,
like have a direct effect on my own flourishing.
Right.
So yeah.
And life. I mean, let's talk about, I think that's been another point of evolution for some Christian voters in America, is to be challenged to say, especially in light of COVID, to say, you know, what does it mean to be a pro-life politician? What does it mean to be pro-life? And, that people's lives have been at risk because of political policies in a very, very real sense. Mm-hmm. And I think I've been pleased to see a little bit more language like that being used in the Democratic Party, and to talk about sanctity of life from a progressive point of view. I think that's been important.
Yeah, I think I found it very heartening lately, in the midst of all the disheartening stuff, to really have seen and heard people talking more clearly about how they are starting to disassociate voting a certain way, right? Like voting for the Republicans with voting for a candidate, right? Or voting, being like, if you are religious, you have to vote Republican. Like people have always attached those two things together. That was a very general statement, but you know, there's been a lot of attaching those two things together, right? If you are religious, you vote Republican. That is how it works. And how there's been this movement of people being very public about saying, I am devout, I am pro-life, I am pro whatever, I'm Christian, I'm a pastor, I'm a person of faith, and I cannot vote for this Republican candidate, right? To say like, you can separate, there's a little more, I think there is a little more nuance. We just, you know, interviewed Sarah Stewart Holland recently, and we really did talk a lot about how nuance is required in these times to have conversations about, you can say, I'm not going to vote for Trump because I don't believe he's Christian. And you can still remain all of the things that have kept you in the Republican Party forever, if that's what you want to do, right? You can still hold those things together. And I think part of what's been so frustrating about this binary system we're in is that like, it just leaves, it's just like you don't get to have nuance. And I think in families, in conversations, in like everything, there's nothing black and white. It's all gray. It's all in the middle. It's all like, we just got to be a little more capable of saying, I can be a Jesus follower and listen to what I think the Bible is saying, and at the same time say, I think the Democratic policies fit that better. Are they Jesus? No.
No.
Only Jesus, right? Like,
absolutely not.
Right? It's like,
wait, what?
Can we separate that all out and say, we're not going to get perfection and we're not going to get a savior from a political party, but what we are going to get is, can we try to get closer, right? Like, can we get closer to what God wants for the world and what God wants for people who are hurting or excluded or being minimized or oppressed. And I'm just like, I think we can. I think we can get closer than we are right now.
You know,
I think God we can get hopes. Closer. And it, right.
I mean, part of what I want to say about that too is that those binaries, I mean, all three of us know how damaging that type of binary can be, because all three of us get left out of that binary. You know, for a lot of the people that I spoke to in these interviews and in my research, the idea that a woman could also be a pastor was just like, those are two things that cannot exist in the same space for a lot of the folks I talked to and a lot of the Christian environments that I was in. You know, when I was at my church in Orange County, some people assumed that I was married to the other pastor because that was just the only way that it could make sense in their head that I would be a pastor at this church, even mm-hmm. though he's 30 years older than me.
Natalia, please tell me no one's ever done that with you and your senior pastor who is male.
But gosh, no, that has not happened. Oh. There's been all the other things, but that one has not happened yet.
No, that was really fun. But I also want to say too, just in continuing to think about this conversation where we do have this sense in the United States where, and again, so many of the people that I would interview, if I would present myself as a Christian, the assumption would be that I was conservative or that I was, Republican. And I think that that certainly intensified during the 80s and the 90s, and has not always been a part of American political history. But the other distinction I want to make is that, again, this is primarily a white phenomenon. For the Black church in the United States, this sense of a Christian drive towards liberation, towards civil rights, and even going back, you know, for some white abolitionists who were part of the movement to end slavery, that there has been alongside this conservative Christian power in America, and this is something that was really important to me to bring up in my book, there is another Christian tradition, most profoundly often lifted up by marginalized groups that I think it has a much more powerful sense of the reality of the gospel of Jesus' words when he says, I have come to let the oppressed go free. I have come to bring liberation to the poor, release to the captives. That sense of Christian mission in America is real. And it has brought about some really great things to America. And so that is, I guess, what keeps me going. Those are the stories in my book, you know, stories of people working on the U.S.-Mexico border, of Latino evangelicals working along in El Paso, Texas. Those stories are real. Those stories are bearers of the gospel. And I think that that too often those stories are missed because they don't have the power and the money and the organization of white conservative Christianity. But that reign is coming to an end. You know, the downfall of so many of those leaders. I mean, sadly, even like today, singer, you know, Chris Rice coming up with all these abuse allegations. That reign is coming to an end, and what's going to be built in its wake, I think we have the opportunity to be a part of it.
I like that. I'll take that.
Yeah. I mean, gotta hold on. You know, resurrection comes only after death. And that's been what I've held on to too, is that resurrection comes only after death. And we're in sort of a death spiral in America. But we are a people who believe in resurrection. And so that's, you know, theology of the cross. I mean, we should be good at this as Lutherans.
We should, huh?
Should.
Meanwhile, everybody's panicking about the death of the church, and you're like, well, let's talk about what that means then, right? Like, okay, right. Okay.
Right.
So is that where you would find, I mean, do you have any other questions?
I'm good. Many questions, but I felt like that was a good place to stop, but now you're just going to keep it rolling. So I guess we're going wherever you're taking it.
I do think, I'm going to sort of wrap it up by saying, like, is that where you find, like, is that where you're holding on to hope right now? Because because I think this is the thing. We're hearing all these stories and all this stuff comes out, and every day it's like you get another gut punch and you're just like, we are in a death spiral. I feel that. I feel that hard. And we have, everybody's having days where we're hitting a wall and we're breaking down and we're like, we're all effed and this is bad, right? This is really, really bad.
And 200,000 Americans have died of COVID, you know, literally a death spiral.
Right. It's just, it's so overwhelming and exhausting and heartbreaking and devastating. And it becomes, you know, we're watching these, the Supreme Court is just going to, like, I feel like there's stuff that's happening that we just can do nothing about, right? It's like, we're just watching it get worse and we can do nothing about it. And I find that to be very hopeless, right? I think it's super easy for us right now as Christians, as progressive Christians or people who would label themselves as not conservative, right? So a not conservative Christian, but somebody who's a Jesus follower and is trying to do something different in the world than the way it's been, or at least in our country than the way it's been typically or historically. I just feel like it is so hard. And so I'm curious where, you know, with what you've heard from people in your book and what you've heard from people as you've gone around and talked about your book and as you've, you know, tried to hold on to hope as we're moving into this new election cycle, where you're finding that. Cause I feel like that is, I need that. My hope, I think the rest of our community needs it too. I just feel like I need to know where people are seeing light and seeing hope still right now.
Well, it stopped snowing. So I think there's the sun, God is peeking through for our hope in this moment here. But I think also, I do. I find myself returning to some of the stories in my book, and I find myself returning to the prophets and the prophetic texts, particularly. I think about a voice shouting in the wilderness, and also this idea that God's voice is not yelling or thunder or cacophony, but a sound of sheer silence. Mm-hmm. And so those voices are still speaking. And when I found out about RBG's death, I was trying to write this article for US Catholic magazine. And as it's about the childcare crisis and what's happening to women in America and how the church is a part of that or not. And I had interviewed all these incredible feminist Catholic thinkers who just see the gospel in a really powerful and active way and are speaking out and using their voices, and women who are working in Catholic relief organizations, Catholic organizations that are pressing for progressive policies. And there have always been in our world people working whose voices are rarely heard, or maybe we hear their voices, you know, hundreds of years later. I mean, I even think of like Martin Luther King Jr. He was hated by a lot of America while he was doing his work in the civil rights movement. And now we teach school kids, oh, everyone loved Martin Luther King Jr. And conservatives will say, well, we should be like Martin Luther King Jr. So I remember that the Christian life is one of struggle. And just to hear these little tiny stories, these little tiny narratives of people working in their space to bring about liberation and freedom and justice and truth. And those little narratives carry me through, and those people that are choosing to act otherwise in their own space, whatever that looks like, that's really what inspires me in the face of really difficult resistance. Those individual stories are important.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, that's beautiful.
Okay. So Angela, if people want to, they can get your book, ideally not on Amazon, but, elsewhere, local bookstores, Red State Christians, Angela Denker. If they want to follow you or find your website or any of that stuff, how can they do that?
Yeah. So, you can go to angeladenker.com and you can send me a message there if you want to get in touch. And I have an upcoming events tab, just with some more different appearances or interviews that I'll be doing. Twitter is probably the best place to follow sort of up to the minute. I actually do a lot of sort of curating. I'm a huge consumer of news and media and reading, and I try to sort of create a feed of sort of articles that might be hopeful or important. Or
yeah, your feed is really good. Yeah.
Thank you. Well, so is yours, Emmy. But yeah, so I try to bring, you know, sort of that, my background as a journalist. So it's Angela_Denker there. And I don't know, just kind of pray for me too. You know, these last few weeks before the election, it's a really intense time for me and for this work. Alongside, you know, pastoring a congregation that's probably leans conservative and in a rural area that voted by 38 points for Trump in 2016. So I'm putting my feet in all sort of different worlds and, you know, just hoping it all turns out okay.
Whew. Yes. Many, many prayers for you in this time. It is a very challenging time to do the work you're doing. So thank you. Thank you for taking time for us today here. We appreciate it. I know this is a busy time for you as we're heading towards the election. So I thank you for giving us this chunk of time today. We really appreciate it.
Agreed. Thank you for the great conversation.
Yeah. Okay. So this has been another episode of Cafeteria Christian. We're so thankful for you all being with us. You know all the ways to reach us on CafeteriaChristian at Gmail and CafeteriaChristian.club and on Instagram and Facebook and all the things. You know, we're not on Twitter, but all of us individually are.
No.
And we're just continuing to hear from people who are new to the podcast, and we just love hearing that. We are coming up on our 100th episode, so we would love to hear stories about how you heard about us and what you think about the podcast. If you want to leave us a review, you can do that, or you can just send us an email and we will maybe include those in our 100th episode. We don't actually know what we're doing on our 100th episode yet, but we'll figure it out. It'll happen.
Don't pull the curtain, Natalia. We're supposed to make it look like we know what we're doing.
We got time to figure it out. It's not like it's next week. It's a couple weeks. So we're good. We got time. So, but we would love to hear from you about why you love this podcast, why you listen, why you continue to listen, or why you've shared it. We would love to hear about that. So if you send us an email or post it on Instagram or, send it in the Facebook group, we'd love to hear from you. We have patrons, patreon.com/cafeteriachristian. I'm just so impressed that people keep finding us and supporting us in this way. We are so thankful for our patrons. The list is long and beautiful, and we're so thankful for all of you and your willingness in this challenging economic time, even to still consider giving us a gift is such a such a gift for us. So thank you so much. So imagine Nora singing Natalie Merchant's
Thank you. Thank you.
And this week we are going to thank Heather Maxey.
Thanks, Heather.
Kristen Jorgensen.
Thanks, Kristen.
And Allison Kiefer.
Thanks, Allison.
Thank you guys. And thank you for all our patrons. We're just, we are very grateful for you. We will have our next First Fruits up. Ashley Fairbanks gave us some options to give, and so we let her choose those, and those will be up on our First Fruits page or on our Patreon page. So if you want to give, we give a portion of our gifts to that. But if you also just want to vote, we vote on who gets the gift. So we give a portion of our patronage to organizations that we choose every month. So,
and your vote counts as long as you're a patron. Like, there's no electoral college, there's no voter suppression. Just give us your money and then we let you vote.
That's right. It
doesn't matter how much. You can't buy more votes. I guess you could if you really wanted to, like, go through the mechanics of creating several different Patreon accounts. But if you care that much about voting for who gets our first fruits, you can just give them the money directly. See? This is how you avoid voter suppression, is you just make it too boring. Yes.
Oh, so anyway, thank you everybody for being with us today, and with faith, with life, with politics, especially. OMG. Mm-hmm. Just do what we do here at Cafeteria Christian. Take what you like
and leave the rest.